You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire, mō tēnā rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Troy. Troy, how have you been during this very terrible time for our city?
I've been actually really good. I'm in an apartment and I have been playing chess again.
Very lucky there. Well, we'll get into some more news about the floods today. Ifai Akine coming up on the show. News sub-editor Stella Huggins speaks to Dr. Suze Wilson, a senior lecturer at Massey University, all about Wayne Brown, our Auckland Mayor's response to the flooding in Tāmaki Makaurau. I interview Dr. Mikael Bulik, a senior lecturer at Massey University in the School of Built Environment, about how people should protect themselves from health hazards such as mould in flood-damaged homes. And Michelle Lelong, Chief Operating Officer at PD Insurance, about protecting our furry friends as well during these ongoing floods. Troy, what will you be discussing today?
Today I'm talking with Victoria University Professor James Renwick about climate change's effect on the weather and natural disasters.
Ki aha o whakaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today, so please do get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text us on 5395 or wire my rane. Give us a call in the studio on 309 3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō hi pakihiri Rocky Rocky mārunga i te pai tuku tuku o Irirangi Pōho. Mi haere ki 95BFM ira kati.com. Catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
The government has indicated a
The Wire.
The flooding in Tāmaki Makaurau has been devastating in a myriad of ways. One aspect that this has clearly troubled a lot of people has been the mayor's response, or lack thereof, in the beginnings of the disaster unfolding. News sub-editor Stella Huggins spoke to Dr. Suze Wilson, a senior lecturer at Massey University, whose area of expertise is in leadership and management, about the nuances of the situation. She started by asking about his performance and overall manner during the critical press conferences and the few interviews he has given, and what, in her opinion, were the features that have led to such a negative reaction from many members of the public.
One thing that is obvious was, you know, his silence on Friday night, the lack of communications during kind of the peak period when, you know, some people are literally, you know, being rescued and swimming out of their homes, and just this kind of silence, because by his own account, what he was focused on was gathering facts and data and evidence and making sure he was following due process. But those are all the kind of management parts of his job. The leadership part of his job, you know, is about communicating proactively to people of, look, it's not looking good out there, guys. Here's some, you know, we're onto it. We're doing everything we can. Some important basic, you know, kind of safety messages are da-da-da-da-da. So he missed all of that on Friday night, and then he's been challenged about that, you know, on Saturday, and got very defensive. It almost seemed like, I don't know, you have to be careful about inferring emotions to other people, but he appeared angry. It looked almost as if his deputy mayor was kind of dragging him off at the end of the interview. There were certain statements he was making where you could kind of see these, you know, sort of sideways glances from the Prime Minister and ministers, as if they're kind of going, what? You're saying what? So there was just this general sense that he was digging an even deeper hole for himself by failing, you know, to understand what the nature of people's concerns were. He seemed to keep wanting to resort back to the technical process involved in declaring a state of emergency. And I don't know what that process is. You know, I'm prepared to take at face value that there was a process to be followed, but that doesn't absolve him of the leadership responsibility. And yeah, the stuff that's come out today about him being more focused on being annoyed his tennis game was cancelled because he had to speak to the media. I mean, you know, this does not instill confidence that he understands what his job actually is.
And you've pointed out the disparity between Brown's capacity for management and the role in leadership. Could you speak a little bit more to that difference in terms of maybe the literature and explain why that distinction matters, especially in these circumstances?
Yes, it is funny because, you know, he is someone who campaigned on the basis of his business and governance experience that he was the person to fix Auckland. But the reality is, you know, even at Management 101 courses, we teach students that, you know, management and leadership are not one and the same thing, that management is important, but it's fundamentally concerned with issues of efficiency and effectiveness and doing things correctly. It's about following processes, gathering facts, data and evidence, all the stuff he was kind of talking about. But that's quite different from leadership, which is much more about connecting in to how people are feeling, understanding, if you like, the strategic bigger picture of what's going on, role modeling appropriate values and behaviours. Sometimes people will call all of that kind of stuff, or they'll kind of equate it with notions of emotional intelligence or soft skills. But it's generally seen to be, you know, quite a distinctive kind of skill set, different from the more kind of analytic, cold, calculating rationality involved in management work. And this is more about connecting with the human issues. And particularly when we look at leadership in relation to crisis leadership, you know, it emphasizes things like trying to basically step back and get a sense of what's going on here, the importance of communicating, working with others, decision making, all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, one way of kind of summing up the differences between the two is something that Warren Bennis famously said, is that management is about doing things right, but leadership is about doing the right thing. And so that's kind of speaking to both the having the strategic and emotional nous to understand what is it that people need, that kind of values and emotional connection to understand what is it that people need to hear in a crisis. They need to hear reassuring messages that we care. This is what we're doing. We don't know all the answers, but we'll keep you informed. Here's what you can do for yourself. All of that stuff that he's just missing.
And on the point of communication, city councillors, MPs, the deputy mayor, the leaders of our two main political parties, a lot more community leaders, they were providing information for their communities. They were giving their two cents on what should happen next. Overall, they were being significantly more vocal and visible than Mr. Brown was at any point. What kind of threat does that pose to people's perception of Mr. Brown's authority and his ability as a leader when that contrast is so stark?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I mean, my sense is that, you know, as I was watching that stuff kind of emerge on Friday night on Twitter in particular, you could kind of sense an increasing tone of concern about the silence from the centre, from headquarters, if you like, that some of those people were expressing. And for me, that really did peak with the Leader of the Opposition, you know, calling on Mr. Brown, please declare a state of emergency. And I just thought, you know, he's on the same side of the political spectrum, publicly basically saying to the mayor, do your job, would you? So that cannot be a good look in terms of his reputation. You know, leadership relies on trust, right? We have to, because our leaders do have authority and power, we want to trust that they're going to use their authority and their power in a good way for good purposes, and that they're competent in exercising those powers. So I think all of that has been dented, and certainly his comments on Saturday did not suggest he had any insight into that. If anything, he made things worse. On Sunday, there was clearly more of an effort. There were regular tweets coming out, both from his account and emergency management. He had scheduled 3 press briefings. He was out, you know, in community centres and talking to people. So that all seemed reasonably encouraging. But then you find out actually what's going on behind the scenes on Saturday night is he's complaining about the drongos, his word, in the media. And it's just like, So I can't help but start to be very sceptical that all of that stuff, you know, was just spin, that he actually hasn't recognised really quite how serious the need is for good leadership in a crisis.
And Mr. Brown obviously has a history in public boards, etc. Is there any work in the literature that discusses past behaviour and past performance, for example, in similar roles such as in 2002 when he was the chair of the Auckland District Health Board and the Senior Medical Doctors Union asked the government to
essentially get rid of him from that board
for creating a, quote, crisis of confidence? So according to the literature, does an individual's past performance indicate how well they might perform in future? I mean, colloquially, there's the argument that a tiger can't change its stripes, but academically, what is the consensus on that?
The research generally in the field of psychology, and I'm not a psychologist, but there's a big overlap between psychology and leadership studies. It does, if you like, generally say the best way we can predict somebody's future behaviour is to look to their past behaviour. Right? So that is, if you like, a well-established thing in the literature. It's also the case, though, that people can learn and grow. That said, there are some indications that learning and growing the kinds of behaviours that he's not engaging in, not being able to empathetically sense what is going on, you know, learning that is actually very difficult for people because it's almost kind of like deeply wired into their whole kind of worldview and their psyche to not be particularly oriented towards being concerned with feelings. So that would be a pretty hard ask. You know, the reality is if a motivated leader knows that they lack in that area, not only would they be trying to work on it, I think they would be asking people around them, please help me to know what it is that people might be feeling and what they need to hear so that I can then role model that. Even if I don't quite get it myself, I'll at least try because I if you like, intellectually grasp that it's important, even if I don't necessarily intuitively feel it. I guess the irony is that soft skills that people, you know, that language, they're actually the hardest to learn. And, you know, that is what he's largely missing.
And on that point, finally, it is a developing situation. Do you think that Mr. Brown has the capacity to improve? And if so, what would your advice be to him for improvement as someone who's well-versed in the topic of what makes a leader?
I mean, I really think he needs to wrap around himself people who actually have skills and abilities in this area and take advice from them and try to act on that advice and to, you know, if he could recognise that his own instincts are actually leading him in the wrong direction here. But that would take a fair degree of both humility and, you know, frankly, personal discipline in terms of managing his own behaviours. And I'm not terribly confident about this. I mean, this is somebody who, prior to being elected, was caught on tape fantasizing about wanting to piss on the image of a journalist. That is not kind of normal behavior, right? So there's something there that I, you know, and he's a mature adult. There's something there that's pretty strongly wired in him that I think is going to be very hard for him to manage. But if he's got, you know, really strong support and he's willing to listen to it, then maybe he can, you know, frankly, keep his foot out of his mouth more often than he has been.
That was Stella Huggins speaking to leadership expert Dr. Suze Wilson about Mayor Wayne Brown's performance in response to the flooding in Tāmaki Makaurau. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Genesis from Grimes. Keep it on the beat.
Thank you. back and coming to the Ōrākei Basin, featuring the one and only Dan Ox.
The most fun you can have on two wheels. Bike Rave takes you on a group ride ending at Ōrākei Basin, where you'll park up for a silent party at the water's edge.
Made possible by Auckland Transport, Bike Auckland, Club Mate and Interesting Things.
Bike Rave Ōrākei with Dan Ox, Saturday, February 11th. Tickets are free but extremely limited. Reserve yours now at Eventbrite.
Oh, I missed you at the party last night. You all good?
I was actually just, you know, sitting at home listening to the radio.
Listen to the radio? Instead of going to your mate's party?
Yeah, just love tuning in.
Yeah.
Turning it up.
Turning it up, yep. Yep, true. Yep.
Just jamming the airwaves.
Just jamming the airwaves instead of going to your mate's party. Yeah. Well, actually, that's incredibly cool and quite sexy and brave. You know, not to go to your mate's party, just to stay home listening to the radio.
95BFM is broadcasting live from the Big Fan Hotbox at the Morningside Live Block Party. So you can be the coolest kid not at the party. Vibing out to sets from the likes of Benny Salvador, Andy Heartthrob, Hazamilu, AJ Honeysuckle, and our very own Dubhead. Morningside Live Block Party. On your radio this Sunday from 4 p.m. Find out more at 95BFM.com.
I don't know how to say this. Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Beetlejuice.
Oh!
Yeah.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. Climate change has become an impending anxiety for many, but as New Zealand faces devastating floods, it has become apparent that the repercussions of the climate disaster are already in effect. Today, I spoke with Victoria University Professor James Renwick about the natural disasters caused by climate change and how these crises may quickly affect our future. James, can you please tell our listeners who may not know how these floods are linked to climate change?
Sure. Well, the link to climate change comes from the relationship between temperature and moisture, water vapour. The warmer the air is, the more water vapour it can hold. So you warm the climate up by a degree or so, and the amount of water vapour in the air goes up by 6 or 7%. So having a warmer climate means we have a more humid climate as well. And so when there's a storm, when there's a way to get that moisture out of the air, the chances are you'll have a heavier rainfall event. And I'm sure that was part of the story with the rainfall in Auckland recently. And I haven't seen the numbers yet. The analysis hasn't been done. But given that we know there's more moisture in the air now, it seems certain that some of that extra moisture fell on the city on Friday night, and actually, yeah, more recently today, I believe it's been raining quite heavily again.
Yeah, it has. So will we see storms and other instances of extreme weather like we are seeing now? And will these events become more frequent due to climate change?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Storms themselves are not expected to become more frequent. So we're not seeing a future where there'll be lots more storms happening. But when storms do happen, they're likely to be stronger, more powerful, and deliver more rain pretty much everywhere in the world. So we could have the same number of storms as we've seen in the past, but a larger fraction of those storms would be delivering really heavy rains to, you know, wherever they're affecting. So in that sense, yeah, there would be more heavy rainfall events, but not necessarily more storms. And, you know, even in the future with another degree of warming or whatever, the event that happened in Auckland on Friday would still be a pretty extreme event. There's more to it than just the fact that the climate's warmer and moister. You've got to get a lot of conditions to put together and just the right way to get that really intense rainfall. And yeah, even in 50 years' time, it would still be pretty uncommon to have such heavy rainfall events. But it wouldn't be as uncommon as it has been in the past or even as today.
So what other extreme weather events could occur due to climate change in the future? Like, for example, could we see things like droughts or earthquakes?
Droughts, certainly. And it's a really curious feature of the way the climate's changing that we see increases in extremes at both ends of the rainfall scale. So when it's raining, more rain, usually, or on average. But when it's not raining, it's warmer, and often it'll be sunnier, and there'll be more evaporation of moisture from the ground and so on. So things dry out faster in a warmer climate. So you can get into drought conditions more quickly. So more droughts and more floods. And the obvious one with temperatures going up is high temperature extremes. And a rule of thumb there is that 2 degrees of warming in this country goes with roughly a tripling of the number of warm days, very warm days. So in Auckland, I don't know, it doesn't really matter too much what you define as a warm day, above 25 degrees, above 30 degrees. If you were getting, say, 30 of those days in the summer before, with a 2 degree warming, you'd be getting 90 of those days in the summer. So every day in the summer would be very warm on average. So certainly, yeah, well, the one thing we don't see more of in the future is cold days, cold nights, frosts are disappearing pretty rapidly around the whole country. Oh, and you mentioned earthquakes. No, there may be a connection between climate change and earthquakes in the sense that, you know, ice is melting from glaciers and ice sheets, and that's changing the stresses on the Earth's surface that maybe affects where earthquakes happen or when they happen, although nobody's really managed to demonstrate that yet. There's really not much connection between climate change and those kind of geological processes, earthquakes and volcanoes and so on.
That was Professor James Renwick discussing how climate change will affect our weather in the future.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
More than 200 homes have been red-stickered and at least 5,000 have been damaged after the devastating deluge across Tamaki Makaurau in the Upper North Island. Experts are warning that health hazards such as mould and contamination could be waiting for residents returning to their homes. I spoke to senior lecturer at Massey University's School of Built Environment, Dr. Michael Bulick, who says Auckland's current conditions are the worst case scenario for mould to grow. We started off our interview discussing what steps people should take when cleaning up their flood damaged property.
So the first thing is make sure that you got clearance from authority. Make sure, because it's your after flooding, your house could be a kind of a risky place, a lot of hazards. So make sure that you've got the right to get back to your house. Something very important also, during flooding, you've got a lot of overflow from sewage. So you can also have not only mold, but viruses, bacteria. You have to be careful of not putting yourself at risk.
Can you tell our listeners about some of the measures they can take to minimise the risk of mould growth and contamination in their homes?
Yeah, so what I would like to do first is to give you a background about how mould is growing. So first, to get mould in your house, you need three things. The first one, it's what we call mold spores, like seeds from plants, from trees. So molds are everywhere, so you've got mold everywhere in your house. Even if it's a dry house, you will have mold coming from trees, coming from inside, coming from activities. So you've got always mold in your house. But what you want, you don't want them to grow. Second, you need food. And mold will have food because mold is growing on fabrics, wood, textile, papers. So mold is growing on any type of support. So you've got the seed or the spores, you've got the food. The last thing you need to control, and it's what we are talking about today, it's the water. It's the only parameters or only factors you can control. So you have to make sure that your house will get dry as soon as possible. The way to dry the house, I mean, in this situation after the flooding in Auckland, I mean, we've got more or less a week of rain after. It's very tricky. And also we are in the worst season because the temperature is very high. And as you know, everything, biological things are growing very well when the temperature is quite warm. So we are in the worst case scenario for mold to grow. So the easiest thing will be to dry as quick as possible. But how do you dry your house when it's raining outside? This is a big question.
How can people properly clean their items that may be flood damaged to prevent mold from spreading on them?
So to clean the items, the first thing will be to make sure that you don't have any overflow from sewage, because you can end up with not only clean water, but also water coming from sewage. So you have to be sure that it's cleanable first. Then after, if there are, what I will recommend instead of using bleach, because I know that a lot of people are using bleach, but it's quite a nasty product for our skin, I will use vinegar and water. So usually people say about 80% vinegar and 20% water. You just mix both together, and it's much, I will say, friendly product than using bleach. And then after, when it's clean, I mean, you think it's clean, you just try to dry it as quick as possible. But again, with this weather during the week, I mean, it will be very hard to clean it and to dry it.
Why is it so important for people to be concerned about mold?
Because mold can trigger a lot of things. For example, if you've got some skin issues, so like eczema or something like this, so mold will trigger, you can have more issues with mold. Again, people with who are immune depressed, also their immune system is depressed, so they have to be careful not be in contact with mold, because mold are producing a mycotoxin. Mold also are producing some allergen, and so you can have some allergy to mold, and if you got from issues like asthma, for example, so asthma could also be triggered by mold, so you have to be careful, because mold could be a nasty product.
Do you have any other advice for our listeners who may be experiencing flood damage in their homes?
So the key issues with mold, as I said, so you've got the spores, you've got the food, so you need to control the water. So if you've got your house been flooded, so the only things you can do is to try to dry it as soon as possible. So if you've got a dehumidifier at home, for example, and with this rainy weather at the moment, what you can do, you can close all windows, you run your dehumidifier as on high speed, or you can even borrow or hire a professional dehumidifier. You can also start your heater, because what you want is to try to dry as quick as possible. So heater plus dehumidifier, trying to remove water from the carpet, remove water from the Jeep, remove water from paper, from clothes, from any product who's been damaged with flooding. So try to remove water as quick as possible. But I understand that with this outside, with this weather at the moment, it could be very tricky. It's a very unfortunate situation at the moment, and very, very tricky. And it's not only mold. I think people are got issues also with the structure of the building, because flooding it was an issue, but also I know that quite a lot of houses got issues with the structure. It's very unfortunate situation for New Zealand at the moment, for Auckland. And as I said, I mean, with this weather, I mean, it's very hard to dry your house. So just, very, very hard. Maybe something we can discuss, how do you know that it's you are ready to go back to your house? So how do you know that you clean the mold? Because the problem with mold also, it's you've got the visible mold and you've got also some mold which are invisible. For example, you've got some mold which are white, and if you got the Jeep, which is a white background, so you won't see the white on white. So it's you won't see it, so you won't clean it. So what I will recommend, it's if you got a very bad damage before moving back, so it's to ask a professional, a lab, to do some sampling and to make sure that there is no very high level of mold in your house. And how do you tell that the level is very high? usually what, because for mold, we don't have a very well-defined guidelines to tell that, for example, a number of spore per liters of air or number of spore per cubic meters of air, it's the norm. So we don't have this type of thing. So what we do usually, we work on what we call the relative quantity. So we compare an area which has been damaged and with an area which has not been damaged. So you do the comparison and you see how far you are from a clean area. So you look at the mold level in the clean area, which is a normal kind of healthy area, and then you go to your flooded area and you do the same samples and you look at the result and you see how much more you got in your flooding area. So what you want is to go back to the normal, the non-damaged area level of mold.
What would the cost be of hiring someone like a professional flood cleaner? Is this something that's going to be, do you think, accessible for everyone, especially those who might already be experiencing some financial pressure because of the impact of the flood on them?
Very good point. It's a very good point. I don't know exactly the cost per hour to hire someone to do some sampling and then after to do some mold identification and counting. But you're right, we might talk about a couple of thousand dollars in total. So yes, it might also put some more pressure, financial pressure on people who have already been impacted. I completely agree with you. Yes, this is an issue also. So I don't know what will be the solution, but I'm talking about making sure that you are healthy, you got back to healthy environment. So it's a very tricky situation because people are being financially impacted and now you ask them to spend more money to make sure that they are living in a healthy environment. I completely agree with this, but it's a reality.
That was Dr. Mikhail Bulik from Massey University speaking on the health hazards caused by flooding. And we'll be back right after this short break. Keep it on the bee.
Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. With widespread flooding affecting Tāmaki Makaurau, pet insurance specialist PD Insurance is advising those with cats and dogs to take special precautions to protect their furry family members. I spoke to Chief Operating Officer Michelle Lelong about what advice they have for pet owners. Here is that interview.
I think, Jessica, for us, the main thing is to take your pets if you do have to evacuate. If you're able to safely get them in their carry case or in their crates and certainly take them away. You know, human safety first, but certainly, you know, get your pets with you. We also recommend that you take at least 3 to 5 days worth of food, so some clean water, their food. If they're on any medication, by all means, you know, pop that in with them. Make sure that they've got a collar and ideally their name on their collar, preferably if they've been microchipped, that's even better. But make sure that you are putting them in and down their crates and transporting them as safely as you can. If you can't get hold of them, let's say that they've gone away and you know, cats will go and find a high, dry area, then leave an upper window open. If you need to leave them in the home, then safely put them upstairs. Cats are pretty resilient. As long as they've got some food and somewhere dry that they can, you know, hide away, they're pretty good. They can swim as well, which a lot of people don't realise. But your dogs, I think, one of the key things is for the dogs not to let them out swimming in the water as well. I think a lot of people don't realise there's a lot of contaminants in the flooded water at the moment. They can come in with E. coli on their fur and also any toxic substances, which you just won't know. And there's also debris, a lot of debris in the flooded water. So recommend don't let them go swimming. Keep them nearby. And if you need to, get them away and safe to stay with families or friends during this flooded time.
During floods, there is potential for pets and their families to be separated. If people have lost their pets or they're looking for their pets, how can they go about the process of finding them?
Look, there's a lot of good groups at the moment. You'll see across Facebook there's Pets Lost in Auckland Floods. So a lot of those sites you can register. If you've got a recent photo, get your photo on there, get it registered. And also the Civil Defence is super good. So 0800 222200. They can also assist if you've got nowhere to stay and you need to take your pets with you. So by all means, I know they're all very inundated at the moment, but there's a couple of great sites, social sites, that can help either relocate you back with your pets or assist you to find someone to look after them if you need to get away and have got no one to take your pets with you.
If someone finds a lost pet, what should they do in that situation?
And I think the best advice we would have is get that photo posted on that Pets Lost in Auckland Facebook site. You can also, the Civil Defence, another good site to note, and also you've got the SPCA as well. So there's a number of good research and rescue centres that you can register that you found them. You would love it if you can care for them until they're reunited with their owners, and the local vet will be able to scan their microchip and also assist you to locate who the pet owner is if the pets have been microchipped as well.
And if pet parents are taking their pets for a walk, what is the safest way they can go about taking their pets for a walk?
Look, I think high ground always. The parks are pretty sodden at the moment, so if you can stick to the footpaths and walk around your neighbourhood, it's a good idea to be checking up on other neighbours as well while you're out and about. But I would stick to the main footpaths and avoid the wet, sodden areas in the parks at the moment. You just don't know, there's a lot of slippages and things like that. So we all want everyone to keep safe and keep to high ground.
That was Chief Operating Officer at PD Insurance, Michelle Lelong, on their advice for pet owners during the current floods.
That was The Wire.
That's a wrap on The Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Dr. Suze Wilson, a senior lecturer at Massey University. Professor James Renwick from Victoria University. Dr. Mikhail Bulik, a senior lecturer at Massey University School of Built Environment, and Michelle Lelong, chief operating officer at PD Insurance. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Bridge.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.